Prince of High Places, the Lord of Dark Mornings. I sinned in pride. So have you all sinned in pride. Ain't you heard it said, put not your faith in the lords and princes of this world?
They watched her.
Electric lights ain't the answer, Stu Redman. CB radio ain't it either, Ralph Brentner. Sociology won't end it, Glenn Bateman. And you doing penance for a life that's long since a closed book won't stop it from coming, Larry Underwood. And your boy child won't stop it either, Fran Goldsmith. The bad moon has risen. You propose nothing in the sight of God.
She looked at each of them in turn.
God will dispose as he sees fit. You are not the potter, but the potter's clay. Mayhap the man in the west is the wheel on which you will be broken. I am not allowed to know.
A tear, amazing in that dying desert, stole from her left eye and rolled down her cheek.
Mother, what should we do? Ralph asked. Draw near, all of you. My time is short. I'm going home to glory, and there's never been no human more ready than I am now. Get close to me.
Ralph sat on the edge of the bed. Larry and Glenn stood at the foot of it. Fran got up with a grimace, and Stu dragged her chair up beside Ralph. She sat down again and took his hand with her own cold fingers.
God didn't bring you folks together to make a committee or a community, she said. He brought you here only to send you further, on a quest. He means for you to try and destroy this dark prince, this man of far leagues.
Ticking silence. In it, Mother Abigail sighed.
I thought it was Nick to lead you, but he's taken Nick. Although not all of Nick is gone yet, it seems to me. No, not all. But you must lead, Stuart. And if it's his will to take Stu, then you must lead Larry. And if he takes you, it falls to Ralph.
Looks like I'm riding drag, Glenn began. What?
Lead?
Fran asked coldly.
Lead?
Lead where?
Why, west, little girl, Mother Abigail said. West. You're not to go, only these four.
No! She was on her feet in spite of the pain. What are you saying? That the four of them are just supposed to deliver themselves into his hands? The heart and soul and guts of the Free Zone? Her eyes blazed.
So he can hang them on crosses and just walk in here next summer and kill everyone?
I won't see my man sacrificed to your killer god. Fuck him!
Franny, Stu gasped.
Killer god! Killer god! She spat. Millions, maybe billions, dead in the plague. Millions more afterward. We don't even know if the children will live. Isn't he done yet? Does it just have to go on and on until the earth belongs to the rats and the roaches? He's no god, he's a demon, and you're his witch.
Stop it, Franny.
No problem. I'm done. I want to leave. Take me home, Stu. Not to the hospital, but back home.
We'll listen to what she has to say.
Fine. You listen for both of us. I'm leaving.
Little girl.
Don't call me that! Her hand shot out and closed around Franny's wrist. Fran went rigid. Her eyes closed. Her head snapped back.
Don't! Oh, my God! Stu!
Here! Here! Stu roared.
What are you doing to her?
Mother Abigail didn't answer.
The moment spun out, seemed to stretch into a pocket of eternity, and then the old woman let go.
Slowly, dazedly, Fran began to massage the wrist Mother Abigail had taken, although there was no red ring or dent in the flesh to show that pressure had been applied.
Franny's eyes suddenly widened.
"Hun?" Stu asked anxiously.
"Gone," Fran muttered.
"What? Well, what's she talking about?"
Stu looked around at the others in shaken appeal. Glenn only shook his head. His face was white and strained, but not disbelieving.
The pain. The whiplash. The pain in my back. It's gone.
She looked at Stu, dazed. "It's all gone. Look." She bent and touched her toes lightly, once, then twice. Then she bent a third time and placed her palms flat on the floor without unlocking her knees. She stood up again and met Mother Abigail's eyes. "Is this a bribe from your God? Because if it is, he can take his cure back. I'd rather have the pain if Stu comes with it."
"God don't lay on no bribes, child," Mother Abigail whispered. "He just makes a sign and lets people take it as they will."
"Stu isn't going west," Fran said, but now she seemed bewildered as well as frightened.
"Sit down," Stu said. "We'll listen to what she has to say."
Fran sat down, shocked, unbelieving, lost at sea. Her hands kept stealing around to the small of her back.
"You are to go west," Mother Abigail whispered. "You are to take no food, no water. You are to go this very day, and in the clothes you stand up in. You are to go on foot. I am in the way of knowing that one of you will not reach your destination, but I don't know which will be the one to fall. I am in the way of knowing that the rest will be taken before this man Flag, who is not a man at all, but a supernatural being. I don't know if it's God's will for you to defeat him. I don't know if it's God's will for you to ever see Boulder again. Those things are not for me to see. But he is in Las Vegas, and you must go there, and it is there that you will make your stand. You will go, and you will not falter, because you will have the everlasting arm of the Lord God of hosts to lean on. Yes, with God's help, you will stand."
She nodded.
"That's all. I've said my piece."
"No," Fran whispered. "It can't be."
"Mother," Glenn said in a kind of croak. He cleared his throat. "Mother, we're not in the way of understanding, if you see what I mean. We're not blessed with your closeness to whatever is controlling this. It just isn't our way. Fran's right. If we go over there, we'll be slaughtered, probably by the first pickets we come to."
"Have you no eyes? You've just seen Fran healed of her affliction by God, through me. Do you think his plan for you is to let you be shot and killed by the Dark Prince's least minion?"
"But, Mother—"
"No."
She raised her hand and waved his words away.
"It's not my place to argue with you or convince, but only to put you in the way of understanding God's plan for you. Listen, Glenn."
And suddenly, from Mother Abigail's mouth, the voice of Glenn Bateman issued, frightening them all and making Fran shrink back against Stu with a little cry.
"Mother Abigail calls him the devil's pawn," this strong masculine voice said, originating somehow in the old woman's wasted chest and emerging from her toothless mouth. "Maybe he's just the last magician of rational thought, gathering the tools of technology against us. Maybe he's something more, something darker. I only know what he is, and I no longer think that sociology or psychology or any other ology will put a stop to him. I think only white magic will do that."
Glenn's mouth hung open.
"Is that a true thing, or are those the words of a liar?"
Mother Abigail said.
I don't know if it's true or not, but they're my words," Glenn said shakily. "Trust, all of you. Trust. Larry, Ralph, Stu, Glenn, Franny. You most particularly, Franny. Trust and obey the word of God."
"Do we have a choice?" Larry asked bitterly. She turned to look at him, surprised.
"A choice? There's always a choice. That's God's way, always will be. Your will is still free. Do as you will. There's no set of leg irons on you. But this is what God wants of you."
That silence again, like deep snow. At last Ralph broke it. "Says in the Bible that David did the job on Goliath," he said. "I'll be going along if you say it's right, Mother." She took his hand. "Me," Larry said. "Me too." "Okay." He sighed and put his hands on his forehead as if it ached. Glenn opened his mouth to say something, but before he could, there was a heavy, tired sigh from the corner, and a thud. It was Lucy, whom they had all forgotten. She had fainted. Dawn touched the edge of the world. They sat around Larry's kitchen table, drinking coffee. It was 10 to 5 when Fran came up the hall and stood in the doorway. Her face was puffy from crying, but there was no limp as she walked. She was, indeed, cured. "She's going, I think," Fran said. They went in, Larry with his arm around Lucy. Mother Abigail's breathing had taken on a heavy, hollow rattle that was horribly reminiscent of the superflu. They gathered around the bed without speaking, deep in awe and afraid. Ralph was sure that something would happen at the end that would cause the wonder of God to stand before all of them, naked and revealed. She would be gone in a flash of light, taken, or they would see her spirit, transfigured in radiance, leaving by the window and going up into the sky. But in the end, she simply died. There was a single final breath, the last of millions. It was drawn in, held, and finally let out. Her chest just didn't rise again. "She's done," Stu muttered. "God have mercy on her soul," Ralph said, no longer afraid. He crossed her hands on her thin bosom, and his tears fell on them. "I'll go," Glenn said suddenly. "She was right. White magic. That's all that's left." "Stu," Franny whispered, "please do say no." They looked at him, all of them. "Now you must lead, Stuart." He thought of Arnett, of the old car carrying Charles D. Campion and his load of death, crashing into Bill Hapscom's pumps like some wicked Pandora. He thought of Denninger and Dietz, and how he had begun to associate them in his mind with the smiling doctors who had lied and lied and lied to him and to his wife about her condition. And maybe they had lied to themselves as well. Most of all, he thought of Franny, and of Mother Abigail saying, "This is what God wants of you." "Franny," he said, "I have to go." "And die." She looked at him bitterly, almost hatefully, and then to Lucy as if for support. But Lucy was stunned and far off, no help. "If we don't go, we'll die," Stu said, feeling his way along the words. She was right. "If we wait, then spring comes. Then what? How are we going to stop him? We don't know. We don't have a clue. We never did. We had our heads in the sand, too. We can't stop him except like Glenn says, white magic, or the power of God." She began to weep bitterly. "Franny, don't do that," he said, and tried to take her hand. "Don't touch me," she cried at him. "You're a dead man. You're a corpse. So don't touch me." They stood around the bed in tableau as the sun came up. Stu and Franny went to Flagstaff Mountain around 11 o'clock. They parked halfway up, and Stu brought the hamper while Fran carried the tablecloth and a bottle of Blue Nun. The picnic had been her idea, but a strange and awkward silence held between them. "Help me spread it," she said, "and watch out for those spiny things." They were in a small slanting meadow 1,000 feet below Sunrise Amphitheater. Boulder was spread out below them in a blue haze. Today it was holy summer again. The sun shone down with power and authority. Crickets buzzed in the grass. A grasshopper leaped up, and Stu caught it with a quick lunge of his right hand. He could feel it inside his fingers, tickling and frightened. "Spit and I'll let you go," he said, the old childhood formula, and looked up to see Fran smiling sadly at him. With quick ladylike precision, she turned her head and spat. It hurt his heart, seeing her do that. "Fran, no, Stu, don't talk about it. Not now." They spread the white lawn tablecloth, which Fran had glommed from the Hotel Boulderado, and moving with quick economy, it made him feel strange to watch her supple grace as she bent and moved, as if there had never been a whiplash injury and sprained back at all. She set out their early lunch, a cucumber and lettuce salad dressed with vinegar, cold ham sandwiches, the wine, and apple pie for dessert.
"Good food, good meat, good God, let's eat," she said.
He sat down beside her and took a sandwich and some salad. He wasn't hungry. He hurt inside. But he ate. When they had both finished a token sandwich and most of the salad, the fresh greens had been delicious, and a small sliver of apple pie each, she said,
"When are you going?"
"Noon," he said. He lit a cigarette, cupping the flame in his hands.
"How long will it take you to get there?"
He shrugged. "Walking? I don't know. Glenn's not young, neither is Ralph, for that matter. If we can make 30 miles a day, we could do it by the 1st of October, I guess."
"And if there's early snow in the mountains or in Utah?"
He shrugged, looking at her steadily.
"More wine?" she asked.
"No, it gives me acid indigestion. It always did." Fran poured herself another glass and drank it off.
"Was she God's voice, Stu? Was she?"
"Franny, I just don't know.
We dreamed of her, and she was. This whole thing is part and parcel of some stupid game. Do you know that, Stuart? Have you ever read the Book of Job?"
"I was never much on the Bible, I guess."
"My mom was. She thought it was very important that my brother Fred and I have a certain amount of religious background. She never said why. All the good it ever did me, so far as I know, was that I was always able to answer the Bible questions on Jeopardy. Do you remember Jeopardy, Stu?"
Smiling a little, he said, "And now here's your host, Alex Trebek."
"That's the one. It was backward. They gave you the answer, you supplied the question. When it came to the Bible, I knew all the questions. Job was a bet between God and the devil. The devil said, 'Sure, he worships you. He's got it soft. But if you piss in his face long enough, he'll renounce you.' So God took the wager. And God won." She smiled dully. "God always wins. God's a Boston Celtics fan, I bet."
"Maybe it is a bet," Stu said. "But it's their lives, those folks down there. And the guy inside you. What did she call him, the chap?"
"She wouldn't even promise about him," Fran said. "If she could have done that, just that, it would have been at least a little bit easier to let you go."
Stu could think of nothing to say.
"Well, it's getting on toward noon now," Fran said. "Help me pack up, Stuart."
The half-eaten lunch went back into the hamper with the tablecloth and the rest of the wine. Stu looked at the spot and thought of how there were only a few crumbs to show where their picnic had been, and the birds would get those soon enough. When he glanced up, Franny was looking at him and crying. He went to her.
"It's all right. I'm being pregnant. I'm always running at the eyes. I can't seem to help it."
"It's okay."
"Stu, make love to me."
"Here? Now?"
She nodded, then smiled a little. "It'll be all right, if we watch out for the spiny things."
They spread the tablecloth again. At the foot of Baseline Road, she made him stop at what had been Ralph and Nick's house until 4 days ago. The entire rear of the house was blown away. The backyard was littered with debris. A shattered digital clock radio sat atop the shredded back hedge. Nearby was the sofa under which Franny had been pinned. There was a patch of dried blood on the back steps. She looked at this fixedly.
"Is that Nick's blood?" she asked him. "Could it be?"
"Franny, what's the point?" Stu asked uneasily.
"Is it?"
"Jesus, I don't know. It could be, I suppose."
"Put your hand on it, Stu."
"Franny, have you gone nuts?" The frown line creased her brow, the "I want" line that he had first noticed back in New Hampshire.
"Put your hand on it."
Reluctantly, Stu put his hand on the stain. He didn't know if it was Nick's blood or not, and believed, in fact, that it probably wasn't, but the gesture gave him a ghastly, crawly feeling.
"Now swear you'll come back."
The step seemed rather too warm here, and he wanted to take his hand away.
"Fran, how can I—" "God can't run all of it," she hissed at him. "Not all of it. Swear, Stu, swear it."
"Franny, I swear to try." I guess that will have to be good enough, won't it?
We have to get down to Larry's.
I know.
But she held him more tightly still.
Say you love me.
You know I do.
I know, but say it. I want to hear it.
He took her by the shoulder. Fran, I love you.
Thank you,
she said, and put her cheek against his shoulder.
Now I think I can say goodbye. I think I can let you go.
They held each other in the shattered backyard. Chapter 60. She and Lucy watched the undramatic start of their quest from the steps of Larry's house. The four of them stood there on the sidewalk for a moment. No packs, no bedrolls, no special equipment, as per instructions. They had all changed into heavy walking shoes.
"Bye, Larry,"
Lucy said. Her face was shiny pale.
"Remember, Stuart," Fran said. "Remember what you swore."
"Yes, I'll remember." Glenn put his fingers into his mouth and whistled. Kojak, who had been investigating a sewer grating, came running.
"Let's go, then," Larry said.
His face was as pale as Lucy's, his eyes unusually bright, almost glittery. "Before I lose my nerve." Stu blew a kiss through his closed fist, something he could not remember doing since the days when his mother saw him off on the school bus. Fran waved back. The tears were coming again, hot and burning, but she did not let them fall. They began. They simply walked away. They were halfway down the block now, and somewhere a bird sang. The midday sun was warm and undramatic. They reached the end of the block. Stu turned and waved again. Larry also waved. Fran and Lucy waved back. They crossed the street. They were gone. Lucy looked almost sick with loss and fear.
"Dear God," she said.
"Let's go in," Fran said.
"I want tea."
They went inside. Fran put the teapot on. They began to wait. The four of them moved slowly southwest during the afternoon, not talking much. They were headed toward Golden, where they would camp this first night. They passed the burial sites, three of them now, and around 4 o'clock, when their shadows had begun to trail out long behind them and the heat had begun to sneak out of the day, they came to the township marker spotted beside the road at the southern edge of Boulder. For a moment, Stu had a feeling that all of them were on the verge of turning together and going back. Ahead of them was darkness and death. Behind them was a little warmth, a little love. Glenn took a bandana out of his back pocket, whipped it into a blue paisley rope, and tied it around his head. Chapter 43. The bald-headed sociologist dons his sweatband, he said hollowly. Kojak was up ahead, over the line into Golden, nosing his way happily through a splash of wildflowers.
"Ah, man," Larry said, and his voice was almost a sob. "I feel like this is the end of everything."
"Yeah," Ralph said. "It do feel like that."
"Anybody want to take 5? Glenn asked without much hope.
"Come on," Stu said, smiling a little. "Do you dog faces want to live forever?" They went on, leaving Boulder behind them. By 9 that night they were camped in Golden, half a mile from where Route 6 begins its twisting, turning course along Clear Creek and into the stone heart of the Rockies. None of them slept well that first night. Already they felt far from home and under the shadow of death. Book 3. The Stand. September 7th, 1990 to January 10th, 1991. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the redwood forests to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. Woody Guthrie. "Hey, trash, what did old Lady Semple say when you torched her pension check?" Carly Yates. When the night has come, and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see,
I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me. Ben E. King. Chapter 61. The Dark Man had set his guard posts all along the eastern border of Oregon. The largest was at Ontario, where I-80 crosses over from Idaho. There were 6 men there, quartered in the trailer of a large Peterbilt truck. They had been there for more than a week, playing poker the whole time with 20s and 50s as useless as Monopoly money. One man was almost $60,000 ahead, and another, a man whose working wage in the pre-plague world had been about $10,000 a year, was over $40,000 in the bucket. It had rained almost the whole week, and tempers in the trailer were getting short. They had come out of Portland, and they wanted to get back there. There were women in Portland. Hung from a spike was a powerful 2-way radio broadcasting nothing but static. They were waiting for the radio to broadcast 2 simple words. Come home. That would mean that the man they were looking for had been captured somewhere else. The man they were looking for was approximately 70 years old, heavyset, balding. He wore glasses and he was driving a white over blue 4-wheel drive, either a Jeep or an International Harvester. He was to be killed when he was finally spotted. They were edgy and bored. The novelty of high-stakes poker for real money had worn off 2 days ago, even for the dullest of them, but not bored enough to just take off for Portland on their own. They had received their orders from the walkin' dude himself, and even after rain-induced cabin fever had set in, their terror of him remained. If they screwed the job up and he found out, God help them all. So they sat and played cards and watched by turns at the sight slit which had been carved through the side of the trailer's steel wall. I-80 was deserted in the dull constant rain. But if the scout happened along, it would be seen, and stopped. "He's a spy from the other side," the walkin' dude had told them, that horrible grin wreathing his chops. Why it was so horrible, none of them could have said, but when it turned your way, you felt as if your blood had turned to hot tomato soup in your veins. "He's a spy, and we could welcome him in with open arms, show him everything, and send him back with no harm done. But I want him. I want them both. And we're going to send their heads back over the mountains before the snow flies. Let them chew on that all winter." And he bellowed hot laughter at the people he had gathered together in one of the conference rooms at the Portland Civic Center. They smiled back, but their smiles were cold and uneasy. Aloud, they might congratulate each other on having been singled out for such a responsibility, but inside they wished that those happy, awful, weasel-like eyes had fixed on anyone but them. There was another large guard post far south of Ontario, at Shayville. Here, there were 4 men in a small house just off I-95, which meanders down toward the Alvord Desert, with its weird rock formations and its dark, sullen streams of water. The other posts were manned by pairs of men, and there were an even dozen of them, ranging from the tiny town of Flora, just off Route 3, and less than 60 miles from the Washington border, all the way down to McDermott on the Oregon-Nevada border. An old man in a blue and white 4-wheel drive. The instructions to all the sentinels were the same. Kill him, but don't hit him in the head. There was to be no blood or bruise above the Adam's apple. "I don't want to send back damaged goods," Randy Flagg told them, and clacked and roared his horrible laughter. The northern border between Oregon and Idaho is marked by the Snake River. If you were to follow the Snake north from Ontario, where the 6 men sat in their Peterbilt playing spit in the ocean for worthless money, you would eventually come to within spitting distance of Copperfield. The Snake takes a kink here that geologists call an oxbow, and near Copperfield the Snake was dammed by the Oxbow Dam. And on that 7th day of September, as Stu Redman and his party trudged up Colorado Highway 6 over 1,000 miles to the east and south, Bobby Terry was sitting inside the Copperfield 5 and Dime, a stack of comic books by his side, wondering what sort of shape the Oxbow Dam was in, and if the sluice gates had been left open or shut. Outside, Oregon Highway 86 ran past the dime store. He and his partner, Dave Roberts, now asleep in the apartment overhead, had discussed the dam at great length. It had been raining for a week. The snake was high. Suppose that old Oxbow Dam decided to let go. Bad news. A rushing wall of water would sweep down on Copperfield, and old Bobby Terry and old Dave Roberts might be washed all the way down to the Pacific Ocean. They had discussed going over to the dam to look for cracks, but finally just hadn't dared. Flag's orders had been specific. Stay undercover. David pointed out that Flag might be anywhere. He was a great traveler, and stories had already sprung up about the way he could suddenly appear in a small out-of-the-way burg where there were only a dozen people repairing power lines or collecting weapons from some army depot. He materialized, like a ghost. Only this was a grinning black ghost in dusty boots with run-down heels. Sometimes he was alone, and sometimes Lloyd Henreid was with him, behind the wheel of a great big Daimler automobile, black as a hearse and just as long. Sometimes he was walking. One moment he wasn't there, and the next moment he was. He could be in L.A. one day, or so the talk went, and show up in Boise a day later, on foot. But as Dave had also pointed out, not even Flag could be in six different places at the same time. One of them could just scoot over to that damned dam, have a look, and scoot back. The odds in their favor were 1,000 to 1. "Good, you do it," Bobby Terry told him. "You have my permission." But Dave had declined the invitation with an uneasy grin, because Flag had a way of knowing things, even if he didn't turn up on the dime. There were some who said he had an unnatural power over the predators of the animal kingdom. A woman named Rose Kingman claimed to have seen him snap his fingers at a number of crows sitting on a telephone wire, and the crows fluttered down onto his shoulders, this Rose Kingman said, and she further testified that they had croaked, "Flag, flag, flag," over and over. That was just ridiculous, and he knew it. Morons might believe it, but Bobby Terry's mother Dolores had never raised any morons. He knew the way stories got around, growing between the mouth that spoke and the ear that listened, and how happy the dark man would be to encourage stories like that. But the stories still gave him an atavistic little shiver, as though at the core of each there was a nugget of truth. Some said he could call the wolves or send his spirit into the body of a cat. There was a man in Portland who said he carried a weasel or a fisher or something less nameable than either in that ratty old Boy Scout pack he wore when he was walking. Stupid stuff, all of it. But just suppose he could talk to the animals like a satanic Dr. Doolittle, and suppose he or Dave walked out to look at that damned dam in a direct contradiction of his orders and was seen. The penalty for disobedience was crucifixion. Bobby Terry guessed that old dam wouldn't break anyway. He shot a Kent out of the pack on the table and lit up, grimacing at the hot, dry taste. In another 6 months, none of the damn cigarettes would be smokable. Probably just as well. Fucking things were death anyway. He sighed and took another comic book off the stack. Some ridiculous fucking thing called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The Ninja Turtles were supposed to be heroes on a half-shell. He threw Raphael, Donatello, and their numbfuck buddies across the store, and the comic book they inhabited fluttered down in a tent shape on top of a cash register. It was things like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, he thought, that made you believe the world was maybe just as well off destroyed. He picked up the next one, a Batman. There was a hero you could at least sort of believe in, and was just turning to the first page when he saw the Blue Scout go by out front, heading west. Its big tires splashed up muddy sheets of rainwater. Bobby Terry stared with his mouth ajar at the place where it had passed. He couldn't believe that the vehicle they were all looking for had just passed his post. To tell the truth, way down deep he had suspected this whole thing was nothing but a make-work shit detail. He rushed to the front door and jerked it open. He ran out on the sidewalk, still holding the Batman comic book in one hand. Maybe the thing had been nothing but a hallucination. Thinking about Flag could get anyone hallucinating. But it wasn't. He caught a glimpse of the scout's roof as it went down over the next hill and out of town. Then he was running back through the deserted Five and Dime, bawling for Dave at the top of his lungs. The judge held onto the steering wheel grimly, trying to pretend there was no such thing as arthritis. And if there was, he didn't have it, and if he did have it, it never bothered him in damp weather. He didn't try to take it any further, because the rain was a fact, a pure D fact, as his father would have said, and there was no hope but Mount Hope. He wasn't getting too far with the rest of the fantasy, either. He had been running through rain for the last 3 days. It sometimes backed off to a drizzle, but mostly it had been nothing more or less than a good old solid downpour. And that was also a pure D fact. The roads were on the point of washing out in some places, and by next spring a lot of them were going to be flat impassable. He had thanked God for the scout many times on this little expedition. The first 3 days, struggling along I-80, had convinced him that he wasn't going to raise the West Coast before the year 2000 if he didn't get off onto the secondary roads. The interstate had been eerily deserted for long stretches, and in places he had been able to weave in and out of stalled traffic in second gear. But too many times he had been forced to hook the scout's winch onto some car's back bumper and yank it off the road to make himself a hole he could crawl through. By Rollins, he'd had enough. He turned northwest on I-287, skirted the Great Divide Basin, and had camped 2 days later in Wyoming's northwest corner, east of Yellowstone. Up here, the roads were almost completely empty. Crossing Wyoming and eastern Idaho had been a frightening, dreamlike experience. He would not have thought that the feeling of death could have set so heavily on such an empty land, nor on his own soul. But it was there, a malign stillness under all that big western sky, where once the deer and the Winnebagoes had roamed. It was there in the telephone poles that had fallen over and not been repaired. It was there in the cold, waiting stillness of the small towns he drove his scout through. Lamont, Muddy Gap, Jeffrey City, Lander, Crowheart. His loneliness grew with his realization of the emptiness, with his internalization of the death feeling. He grew more and more certain that he was never going to see the Boulder Free Zone again, or the people who lived there, Franny, Lucy, the Lauder boy, Nick Andros. He began to think he knew how Cain must have felt when God exiled him to the land of Nod. Only that land had been to the east of Eden. The judge was now in the west. He felt it most strongly crossing the border between Wyoming and Idaho. He came into Idaho through the Targhee Pass and stopped by the roadside for a light lunch. There was no sound but the sullen boil of high water in a nearby creek, and an odd grinding sound that reminded him of dirt in a door hinge. Overhead, the blue sky was beginning to silt up with mackerel scales. Wet weather coming, and arthritis coming with it. His arthritis had been very quiet so far, in spite of the exercise and the long hours of driving, and what was that grinding sound? When he had finished his lunch, he got his gerund out of the scout and went down to the picnic area by the stream. It would have been a pleasant place to eat in kindlier weather. There was a small grove of trees, several tables spotted among them. And hanging from one of the trees, his shoes almost touching the ground, was a hanged man, his head grotesquely cocked, his flesh nearly picked clean by the birds. The grinding, creaking sound was the rope slipping back and forth on the branch over which it had been looped. It was almost frayed through. That was how he had come to know he was in the West. That afternoon, around 4 o'clock, the first hesitant splashes of rain had struck the scout's windshield. It had been raining ever since. He reached Butte City 2 days later, and the pain in his fingers and knees had gotten so bad that he had stopped for a full day, holed up in a motel room. Stretched out on the motel bed in the great silence, hot towels wrapped around his hands and knees, reading Lapham's Law and the Classes of Society, Judge Ferris looked like a weird cross between the Ancient Mariner and a Valley Forge survivor. Stocking up well on aspirin and brandy, he pushed on, patiently searching out secondary roads, putting the scout in four-wheel drive, and churning his muddy way around wrecks rather than using the winch when he could, so as to spare himself the necessary flexing and bending that came with attaching it. It was not always possible. Approaching the Salmon River Mountains on September 5th, 2 days ago, he had been forced to hook onto a large Contel telephone truck and haul it 1.5 miles in reverse before the shoulder fell away on one side and he was able to dump the bastardly thing into a river for which he had no name. On the night of September 4th, one day before the Contell truck and 3 days before Bobby Terry spotted him passing through Copperfield, he had camped in New Meadows, and a rather unsettling thing happened. He had pulled in at the Ranch Hand Motel, got a key to one of the units in the office, and had found a bonus. A battery-operated heater, which he set up by the foot of his bed. Dusk had found him really warm and comfortable for the first time in a week. The heater put out a strong, mellow glow. He was stripped to his underwear shorts, propped up on the pillows, and reading about a case where an uneducated black woman from Brixton, Mississippi, had been sentenced to 10 years on a common shoplifting offense. The assistant DA who had tried the case and 3 of the jurors had been black, and Lapham seemed to be pointing out that... Tap, tap, tap. At the window. The judge's old heart staggered in his chest. Lapham went flying. He grabbed for the Garand leaning against the chair and turned to the window, ready for anything. His cover story went flying through his mind like jackstraws blown in the wind. This was it. They'd want to know who he was, where he'd come from. It was a crow. The judge relaxed, a little at a time, and managed a small, shaken smile. Just a crow. It sat on the outer sill in the rain, its glossy feathers pasted together in a comic way, its little eyes looking through the dripping pane at one very old lawyer and the world's oldest amateur spy, lying on a motel bed in western Idaho, wearing nothing but boxer shorts with Los Angeles Lakers printed all over them in purple and gold, a heavy law book across his big belly. The crow seemed almost to grin at the sight. The judge relaxed all the way and grinned back. That's right, the joke's on me. But after 2 weeks of pushing on alone through this empty country, he felt he had a right to be a little jumpy. Tap, tap, tap. The crow, tapping the pane of glass with his beak. Tapping as he had tapped before. The judge's smile faltered a bit. There was something in the way the crow was looking at him that he didn't quite like. It still seemed almost to grin, but he could have sworn it was a contemptuous grin, a kind of sneer. Tap, tap, tap. Like the raven that had flown in to roost on the bust of Pallas. When will I find out the things they need to know, back in the free zone that seems so far away? Nevermore. Will I get any idea what chinks there might be in the dark man's armor? Nevermore. Will I get back safe? Nevermore. Tap, tap, tap. The crow, looking in at him, seemed to grin. And it came to him with a dreamy, testicle-shriveling certainty that this was the dark man, his soul, his ka somehow projected into this rain-drenched, grinning crow that was looking in at him, checking up on him. He stared at it, fascinated. The crow's eyes seemed to grow larger. They were rimmed with red, he noticed, a darkly rich ruby color. Rainwater dripped and ran, dripped and ran. The crow leaned forward and, very deliberately, tapped on the glass. The judge thought, it thinks it's hypnotizing me. And maybe it is a little. But maybe I'm too old for such things. And suppose... It's silly, of course, but suppose it is him. And suppose I could bring that rifle up in one quick snap motion. It's been 4 years since I shot any skeet, but I was club champion back in 76 and again in 79, and still pretty good in 86. Not great. No ribbon that year, so I gave it up. My pride was in better shape than my eyesight by then. But I was still good enough to place 5th in a field of 22. And that window's a lot closer than skeet shooting distance. If it was him, could I kill him? Trap his ka, if there is such a thing, inside that dying crow body? Would it be so unfitting if an old geezer could end the whole thing by the undramatic murder of a blackbird in western Idaho? The crow grinned at him. He was now quite sure it was grinning. With a sudden lunge, the judge sat up, bringing the Garand up to his shoulder in a quick, sure motion. He did it better than he ever would have dreamed. A kind of terror seemed to seize the crow. Its rain-drenched wings fluttered, spraying drops of water. Its eyes seemed to widen in fear. The judge heard it utter a strangled caw, and he felt a moment's triumphant certainty. It was the black man, and he had misjudged the judge, and the price for it would be his miserable life. "Eat this," the judge thundered, and squeezed the trigger. But the trigger would not depress, because he had left the safety on. A moment later the window was empty, except for the rain. The judge lowered the gerund to his lap, feeling dull and stupid. He told himself it was just a crow, after all, a moment's diversion to liven up the evening. And if he had blown out the window and let the rain in, he would have had to go to the botheration of changing rooms. Lucky, really. But he slept poorly that night, and several times he started awake and stared toward the window, convinced that he heard a ghostly tapping sound there. And if the crow happened to land there again, it wouldn't get away. He left the safety catch off the rifle. But the crow didn't come back. The next morning he had driven west again, his arthritis no worse, but certainly no better, and at just past 11 he had stopped at a small cafe for lunch. And as he finished his sandwich and thermos of coffee, he had seen a large black crow flutter down and land on the telephone wire half a block up the street. The judge watched it, fascinated. The red thermos cup stopped dead halfway between the table and his mouth. It wasn't the same crow, of course not. There must be millions of crows by now, all of them plump and sassy. It was a crow's world now. But all the same, he felt that it was the same crow, and he felt a presentiment of doom, a creeping resignation that it was all over. He was no longer hungry. He pushed on. Some days later, at 12:15 in the afternoon, now in Oregon and moving west on Highway 86, he drove through the town of Copperfield, not even glancing toward the Five and Dime, where Bobby Terry watched him go by, slack-jawed with amazement. The gerund was beside him on the seat, the safety still off, a box of ammo beside it. The judge had decided to shoot any crow he might see. Just on general principles.
"Faster! Can't you move this fucking thing any faster?" "You get off my ass, Bobby Terry. Just because you were asleep at the switch is no reason to get on my butt."
Dave Roberts was behind the wheel of the Willys International that had been parked nose out in the alley beside the Five and Dime. By the time Bobby Terry had gotten Dave awake and up and dressed, the old geezer in the Scout had gotten a 10-minute start on them. The rain was coming down hard and visibility was poor. Bobby Terry was holding a Winchester across his lap. There was a .45 Colt tucked in his belt. Dave, who was wearing cowboy boots, jeans, a yellow foul-weather slicker, and nothing else, glanced over at him.
"You keep squeezing the trigger of that rifle and you're going to blow a hole right through your door, Bobby Terry."
"You just catch him," Bobby Terry said. He muttered to himself.
"The guts. Gotta shoot him in the guts. Dass and mark the head. Right.
Stop talking to yourself. People who talk to theirselves play with theirselves, that's what I think."
"Where is he?" Bobby Terry asked.
"We'll get him, unless you dreamed the whole thing. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes if you did, brother."
"I didn't. It was that scout."
"But what if he turns off?"
"Turns off where?" Dave asked. "There's nothing but farm roads all the way to the interstate. He couldn't get 50 feet up a one of them without going into the mud up to his fenders, four-wheel drive and all. Relax, Bobby Terry."
Bobby Terry said miserably, "I can't. I keep wondering how it'd feel to get hung up to dry on some telephone pole out in the desert."
"Can that. And look at there. See him? We're sniffing up his ass now, by God."
Ahead of them was a months-old head-on collision between a Chevy and a big heavy Buick. They lay in the rain, blocking the road from one side to the other, like the rusted bones of unburied mastodons. To the right, deep fresh tire tracks were printed into the shoulder.
"That's him," Dave said. "Those tracks ain't 5 minutes old."
He swung the Willys out and around the smash-up, and they bounced wildly along the shoulder. Dave swung back onto the road where the judge had before him, and they both saw the muddy herringbone pattern of the scout's tires on the asphalt. At the top of the next hill, they saw the scout just disappearing over a knoll some 2 miles distant.
"Howdy doody," Dave Roberts cried. "Go for broke."
He floored the accelerator and the Willys crept up to 60. The windshield was a silvery blur of rain that the wipers could not hope to keep up with. At the top of the knoll, they saw the scout again, closer. Dave yanked out his headlight switch and began to work the dimmer switch with his foot. After a few moments, the scout's taillights flashed on.
"All right," Dave said. "We act friendly. Get him to step out. Don't you go off half-cocked, Bobby Terry. If we do this right, we're going to have a couple of suites at the MGM Grand in Vegas. Fuck it up, and we're going to get our assholes cored out. So don't you fuck it up. Get him to step out."
"Oh, my God, why couldn't he have come through Robinette?" Bobby Terry whined. His hands were locked on the Winchester. Dave whacked at one of them.
"You don't carry that rifle out either."
"But shut up. Get a smile on, goddamn you."
Bobby Terry began to grin. It was like watching a mechanical funhouse clown grin.
"You no good," Dave snarled. "I'll do it. Stay in the goddamn car."
They had pulled even with the scout, which was idling with two wheels on the pavement and two on the soft shoulder. Smiling, Dave got out. His hands were in the pockets of his yellow slicker. In the left-hand pocket was a .38 police special. The judge climbed carefully down from the scout. He was also wearing a yellow rain slicker. He walked carefully, burying himself the way a man might bear a fragile vase. The arthritis was loose in him like a pack of tigers. He carried the Garand rifle in his left hand.
"Hey, you won't shoot me with that, will you?" the man from the Willys said with a friendly grin.
"I guess not," the judge said. They spoke over the steady hiss of the rain. "You must have been back in Copperfield."
"So we were.
I'm Dave Roberts." He stuck out his right hand. "Ferris is my name," said the judge, and put out his own right hand. He glanced up toward the passenger window of the Willys and saw Bobby Terry leaning out, holding his .45 in both hands. Rain was dripping off the barrel. His face, dead pale, was still frozen in that maniacal funhouse grin.
"Oh, bastard," the judge murmured, and pulled his hand out of Roberts's rain-slippery grip just as Roberts fired through the pocket of his slicker. The bullet plowed through the judge's midsection, just below the stomach, flattening, spinning, mushrooming, coming out to the right of his spine, leaving an exit hole the size of a tea saucer. The Garand fell from his hand onto the road, and he was driven back into the scout's open driver's side door. None of them noticed the crow that had fluttered down to a telephone wire on the far side of the road. Dave Roberts took a step forward to finish the job. As he did, Bobby Terry fired from the passenger window of the Willys. His bullet took Roberts in the throat, tearing most of it away. A fury of blood cascaded down the front of Roberts's slicker and mixed with the rain. He turned it toward Bobby Terry, his jaw working in soundless, dying amazement, his eyes bulging. He took two shuffling steps forward, and then the amazement went out of his face. Everything went out of it. He fell dead. Rain plinked and drummed on the back of his slicker.
"Oh, shit, look at this," Bobby Terry cried in utter dismay.
The judge thought, "My arthritis is gone. If I could live, I could stun the medical profession. The cure for arthritis is a bullet in the guts. Oh, dear God, they were laying for me. Did Flagg tell them?" "He must have. Jesus help whoever else the committee sent over here." The Garand was lying on the road. He bent for it, feeling his guts trying to run right out of his body. Strange feeling. Not very pleasant. Never mind. He got hold of the gun. Was the safety off? Yes. He began to bring it up. It seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds. Bobby Terry ripped his stunned gaze away from Dave at last, just in time to see the judge preparing to shoot him. The judge was sitting on the road. His slicker was red with blood from chest to hem. He had settled the barrel of the Garand on his knee. Bobby snapped a shot and missed. The Garand went off with a giant thunderclap, and jagged glass sprayed Bobby Terry's face. He screamed. Sure, he was dead. Then he saw that the left half of the windshield was gone, and understood that he was still in the running.
The judge was ponderously correcting his aim, swiveling the Garand perhaps 2 degrees on his knee. Bobby Terry, his nerves entirely shot now, fired 3 times in rapid succession. The first bullet spanged a hole through the side of the scout's cab. The second struck the judge above the right eye. A .45 is a large gun, and at close range it does large, unpleasant things. This bullet took off most of the top of the judge's skull and hurled it back into the scout. His head tilted back radically, and Bobby Terry's third bullet struck the judge 1/4 of an inch below his lower lip, exploding his teeth into his mouth, where he aspirated them with his final breath. His chin and jawbone disintegrated. His fingers squeezed the Garand's trigger in a dying convulsion, but the bullet went wild into the white rainy sky. Silence descended. Rain drummed on the roofs of the scout and the Willies, on the slickers of the 2 dead men. It was the only sound until the crow took off from the telephone wire with a raucous caw. That startled Bobby Terry out of his daze. He got slowly down from the passenger seat, still clutching the smoking .45.
"I did it," he said confidentially to the rain. "Killed his ass, you better believe it. Shoot out at the OK Corral. Fucking A right. Old Bobby Terry just killed him as dead as you'd want."
But with dawning horror, he realized that it wasn't the judge's ass he'd killed after all. The judge had died leaning back into the scout. Now Bobby Terry grabbed the lapels of his slicker and yanked him forward, staring at what remained of the judge's features. There was really nothing left but his nose. To tell the truth, that wasn't in such hot shape either. It could have been anyone. And in a dream of terror, Bobby Terry again heard Flagg saying, "I want to send him back undamaged." Holy God, this could be anyone. It was as if he had set out to deliberately do just the opposite of what the walking dude had ordered. 2 direct hits in the face. Even the teeth were gone. Rain, drumming, drumming. It was over here, that was all. He didn't dare go east, and he didn't dare stay in the west. He would either wind up riding a telephone pole bareback or something worse. Were there worse things? With that grinning freak in charge, Bobby Terry had no doubt there were. So what was the answer? Running his hands through his hair, still looking down at the ruined face of the judge, he tried to think. South. That was the answer. South. No border guards anymore. South to Mexico, and if that wasn't far enough, get on down to Guatemala, Panama, maybe fucking Brazil. Opt out of the whole mess. No more east, no more west. Just Bobby Terry, safe and as far away from the walking dude as his old boogie shoes could carry. A new sound in the rainy afternoon. Bobby Terry's head jerked up. The rain, yes, making its steel drum sound on the cabs of the 2 vehicles, and the grumbling of 2 idling motors, and a strange clocking sound, like run-down boot heels hammering swiftly along the secondary road macadam. "No," Bobby Terry whispered. He began to turn around. The clocking sound was speeding up. A fast walk, a trot, a jog, run, sprint, and Bobby Terry got all the way around. Too late. He was coming. Flagg was coming like some terrible horror monster out of the scariest picture ever made. The dark man's cheeks were flushed with jolly color, his eyes were twinkling with happy good fellowship, and a great hungry voracious grin stretched his lips over huge tombstone teeth, shark teeth, and his hands were held out in front of him, and there were shiny black crow feathers fluttering from his hair. "No," Bobby Terry tried to say, but nothing came out.
"Hey, Bobby Terry! You screwed it up!"
the dark man bellowed, and fell upon the hapless Bobby Terry. There were worse things than crucifixion. There were teeth. Chapter 62 Dana Jurgens lay naked in the huge double bed, listening to the steady hiss of water coming from the shower,
and looked up at her reflection in the big circular ceiling mirror, which was the exact shape and size of the bed it reflected. She thought that the female body always looks its best when it is flat on its back, stretched out, the tummy pulled flat, the breast